Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
Welcome to the Social Network Show. We, Jim Nico and I, Dr. J, are coming to you from the studios of KUNV.org. That is where you'll find awesome programming and be able to listen to all sorts of great things emanating from this very studio. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Dr. J, from the socialnetworkstation.com.
Our show is brought to you in part by Nevada Sun Dental. You've heard of medical tourism? Well, why not plan some dental tourism to fabulous Las Vegas? Please listen for details in Dr. Moe's ad later in the show. Today, you will hear from Nina Burley, updating us on the latest decision in the Italian trial of Amanda Knox. We will discuss how the gruesome murder of Meredith Kircher, the beloved daughter of a British family, has been followed via the social internet, creating a separate phenomenon in itself. On the second half of today's show, you will hear from Harvard professor Maria Tatar, chair of the program in folklore and mythology, where she teaches courses in German studies, folklore, and fairy tales.
What does mythology and folklore have to do with social networks?
Okay, I can explain this. Now, you know that online aggression or any kind of aggression and antisocial behavior indicates, to most people would agree, indicates a lack of sympathy, empathy, fellow feeling, and so forth. And it seems that one of the main ways of increasing or building character and empathy in children is through reading together. And so, naturally, most parents start with fairy tales or popular children's stories, and that's where Dr. Tatar comes in. She specializes in that, and she has some marvelous illustrated books about fairy tales. Annotated Peter Pan, for instance. And we're also going to discuss about the content of fairy tales and if they are still appropriate and so forth. So that's the connection, Jim.
Thank you.
Nina Burley, our first guest, is an award-winning investigative journalist and author of 5 books, including her latest, The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Trials of Amanda Knox, a New York Times bestseller. Nina has also written in the New York Observer and has written for many other publications, including Rolling Stone, Business Week, New York, and the New York Times. She's appeared on Good Morning America, Nightline, The Today Show, 48 Hours, and SMBC. And CNN, to name a few. Nina is also an adjunct professor of journalism at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism and has lectured around the United States and other countries. It was her article in the Rolling Stone about Audrey Potts, the cyber abuse victim, that introduced us to Nina. Nina will be sharing updates of the Italian High Court's review of the Amanda Knox trial and social media's role. Nina Burley, New York journalist. Hello and welcome to the show.
Hello and thank you for having me.
So I know today's been pretty crazy because of the breaking news yesterday. Can you tell us what's going on?
Well, you know, most people in America who aren't paying attention to this story thought that the case and the story were over in 2011 when an appellate court in Italy overturned the conviction of Amanda Knox and her then-boyfriend, Sollecito, and Amanda Knox came home after 4 years in jail and went back to Seattle. However, while nobody was really paying close attention, except for people who cover it, the prosecutor, as is his right under Italian law, appealed that acquittal to the Supreme Court, and the Italian Supreme Court last year agreed with him that the case needed to be looked at more closely. So they sent it down to a different appellate panel in a different town in Florence, out of Perugia. And yesterday that appellate panel, with apparently working with citizen jurors, ruled that the case, the conviction was valid and that they are guilty of murder. So Amanda Knox is a convicted murderess once again. And her boyfriend, who had gone back to Italy like a good citizen to testify in his own defense, was last night stripped of his passport and taken to a questura, or a police station.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's the one that is really facing the music here, since he is Italian and is in the country.
Absolutely.
So where do things stand now?
This is a very, the Italian system is more complicated than ours. It's got more steps. So the defendants now will appeal this. They can appeal again. So see, the prosecutor appealed, now they can appeal. I don't know how many times they can go back and forth before it actually ever ends. It may keep going on like a ping pong game.
Uh-huh.
But at the moment, I'm sure that the defendants are going to make their appeal and try to persuade the judges in a different place that they're innocent. My take on it, of course, as you know, because we've talked about this before, is that the prosecutors made a mistake the first time around. Mm-hmm. They arrested the wrong people, and then when they got their fingerprints and DNA evidence back, they realized that that material belonged to a third person, who they then arrested, Rudy Gaudet, who had scammed out of the country while these two students were hanging around going into the police station every day. And instead of throwing out their theory, they merely altered it to put Rudy Gaudet in their story. And so basically, they made a mistake. And when I talk about this, sometimes I get accused, especially in social media, because you're watching now Twitter and Facebook, and you are actually experiencing what happens when you say anything about this case on social media. There are people who come out of the woodwork, and there's some rabid feelings about this. And whenever I say anything about the Italian prosecutor, it's, oh, you hate Italy, you don't appreciate the Italian system, you're disrespecting the system. And I just want to make it very clear to your listeners that the mistakes that the prosecutor made in Italy are mistakes that prosecutors make all over the place, and they make them here in the United States. And the mistakes, and prosecutors, when they make mistakes, generally don't like to admit it, and they don't like to get, if they've arrested people, they don't like to turn around their case when they've moved down the road that far. It takes a very wise and brave person to say, I made a mistake. And in this case, this is a walled mountain town. They're used to doing things their own way. They have this case, and suddenly the world media was inside the mountain town walls,
mm-hmm.
right? And the spotlight was on them, which made it even worse, made it even less likely that they were going to correct their mistake, which it is. It is a mistake. Now, why the appellate panel upheld the conviction is not clear. They didn't release any paper with it. They will eventually release their findings, their mm-hmm. thinking, but I can tell you that it's an appeal, so they didn't put any new evidence into the case, right? An appeal means you're just looking at what is already out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so based on what was in the trial, I don't think that they have a case. They still don't have a case against these students. And what they should have been doing is bringing Rudy Gaudet out of whatever cell they've got him holed up in and make him tell the truth about what happened. He's never denied being in the room with Meredith Kircher bleeding to death in front of him. He's obsessed with this. It's an image that he can't get out of his mind. When he spoke in public, he spoke about how he couldn't get the color red out of his mind. He's a guilty man, and he's never denied it. And they need to get him to explain what he was doing in that house. Mm-hmm. And that's how they're going to solve this case. And you know, I don't know how you do that, but That's the answer.
Well, you have referred to this case as archetypal, that there's the nature of the case itself, but also the nature of the internet. And a professor of law at George Washington University, Daniel Solove, he has done a lot of work on the reputation, gossip, rumor, and privacy on the internet is one of his books. And he made the statement that when you have a bunch of people together all trying to achieve the same goal, the whole starts to take on a mind of its own. And people start to act in extreme ways that they might not otherwise act. So how would you fit that into what has happened in this case?
Well, I think that they're in this town and you know, they have certain belief system, and there is, you know, everything in this case, from, you know, beautiful woman, evil woman, good woman, you know, these are archetypes that go back deep into human, or certainly into patriarchal human history. Mm-hmm. And for thousands and thousands of years in the religions and the cultures, and they're recognizable around the world. And so people are affected by that in different ways. And you can see it on the internet. You can see the way people are just coming out of the woodwork with absolute venom and hatred towards mm-hmm. Amanda Knox, fury. And, you know, there are people who are just sitting in their couches and feeling these emotions. And then you've got the national pride issues where, you know, immediately after the verdict on Twitter, some Italian guy tweeted in Italian something to the effect of, well, they got her like they should have gotten the pilots who caused the slaughter at Chernobyl. And that's the, he's referring to American, top gunners who, you know, Navy guys, I believe, they could be Marines, I'm not sure, but they flew their planes too low. They were playing some kind of like dodge game in the sky and from one of those Italian bases, and they flew too low and they cut a cable of a cable car at a ski place, I think, and 20 people died. The American pilots were never prosecuted or punished in any way. So the Italians are furious about this. Mm-hmm. Course, right?
As well, they should be.
And other things that Americans have done in America, you know, American heavy-handedness in the world. It's all, you know, I wrote a column actually today for CNN.com where I say, you know, she might as well be like a drone. Like they look at her and they see a drone.
Mm-hmm.
She represents American, you know, aggressiveness and American casualness and all these things that Europeans think about Americans. They're plastered it on her. And then finally, you've got the racial thing with Rudy, which is one of the reasons why they don't talk about him very much and why the prosecutor got away with not investigating him, which is there's this belief, and it's actually correct, that innocent black men are railroaded by white judicial systems,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's true. Like, our jails are full of black men, and, you know, many of them are innocent. So in Italy, lots of prejudice. It's a homogeneous white society, and they prefer to think of themselves as very enlightened and not racist. And so there's this reverse thing going on where they think, well, most white people would say it's the black guy who did it,
mm-hmm.
and so we're not going to do that. And, you know, in this case, if you take the race out of it,
mm-hmm.
what happened was it's a male-on-female violence that is utterly common around the world. Male violence is the leading cause of death among women in the entire world. If you take his color off him, then you don't have that. But because there's a race issue, then they take that and they make that, you know, the primary issue. And, of course, that feeds into it assists this theory that was created really to cover up a mistake that the prosecutors made.
So they're thinking that, well, all of these Americans have gotten away with murder, such
exactly.
as with the jet and or the plane.
Yeah,
and that was a tragic and very. You know, I can certainly see how angry they would be over that. So we didn't get them that time, we'll get them this time. And Amanda Knox, as we've talked about before, is the master of the ill-advised remark, and she digs herself into holes a lot of times. But that doesn't necessarily mean that she was guilty of this gruesome murder. So, well, thank you so much for checking back in with us. And I think it does show not only how engaged people get with a story like this, but also the nature of the internet. Like hearkening back to Marshall McLuhan, the medium is the message. There are things about communicating on the internet that allow people or somehow even encourage them to be very vitriolic and unmeasured in their responses and their views. And I think that's an important aspect of it.
And Nina, I just wanted to say, Jim here, I wanted to tell you that I tweeted out this morning to all the networks that you were going to be on the show, and especially because I think that your very insightful and cool demeanor does tend to bring a balance to the discussion. I mean, I really respect you, and there are those out there
Thank
that
you.
Really do. And I just wanted to get hope. It looks like you're getting the mass coverage in your book, et cetera. And we hope that you continue to stick with us, too. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. Nina Burley, the author of The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Trials of Amanda Knox.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
This is Jim Nico with Dr. J. Listen to Lori Ruff, the voice of InfluenceRadio.net, Thursdays, 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 Pacific, right here on the Social Network Station. What could make you eager for a trip to the dentist? Well, what if it meant a trip to Las Vegas? With USC training and 18 years of experience, your Las Vegas dentist is expert in fillings, root canals, crowns, veneers, implants, and clear braces. Dr. Naheed Mohammadi's office is easy to get to from the Las Vegas Strip. Dr. Mo strives for long-lasting solutions with quality materials and superb workmanship. Find her online at NevadaSunDental.com. To schedule, just dial your country's exit code. Often 00, then 1-702-898-0800. Whether you speak English, Spanish, or Farsi, you'll feel right at home, and of course, locals are welcome. 702-898-0800.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Dr. Maria Tatar is a Harvard professor of Germanic languages and literatures. She chairs the program in folklore and mythology, where she teaches courses in German studies, folklore, children's literature. And she is the author of several annotated versions of Peter Pan, Hans Christian Andersen, Brothers Grimm, classic fairy tales, and a number of other books about the Germanic literature contributing to fairy tales and folk stories that all of us were read as children in many cases. She's received fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Studies, and the National Endowment for the Humanities. She's written for the New York Times, the New Republic, and the Harvard Crimson. Her work has also been featured on the Today Show and in Harvard Magazine. Welcome to the Social Network Show, Dr. Tatar.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
You know, we've been talking a lot on the show about the lack of empathy, sympathy, fellow feeling that is evidenced a lot of time in electronic aggression of one sort or another, whether over the cell phone or the internet and so forth. And, you know, when we talk about developing empathy or helping children develop character, how does reading with your child help them build character, do you think?
Well, reading is, for one thing, a very gentle technology. It is a way, a medium for developing empathy, because what happens when we read these stories? We become curious about the lives of others. What if this happens to that person? And we not only develop a sense of empathy for these characters that we read about, but the great thing is we get to see inside their mind to understand what makes them tick. And I think that that is just something so important in human development, developing a sense of curiosity that I think almost automatically makes you feel something for the other person.
And that, of course, is the heart and soul of empathy, to relate to not just our own point of view, but what's happening to the other one. So as reading a story, this can actually develop into a dialogue. It's not just parent reading story.
Oh, absolutely. We have this great opportunity for a contact zone between adults and children. You know, really at age, I love to watch one-year-olds biting books, you know, devouring their voracious readers in a way. And, you know, just observing how they start to relate to books. And then as you begin to read with a child, you don't just take in the story. I think the real benefit of bedtime reading is that you have a beautiful story, maybe a horrible story, a terrifying story as well, but it's something that you can then have a conversation about. And that's just such a golden opportunity, I think, not necessarily to teach and preach to the child, mm-hmm. but, you know, to develop values, ideas about aspirations, all kinds of things. And, you know, I think often curiosity is the key there, because once you get curious about other people, you stop seeing them as the other, as monsters, as strangers, but you want to kind of figure out what it is that is driving them.
Well, one thing, if I may just interject, I've been driving myself crazy on this. Did Alice really go down the rabbit hole? I mean, I'm just, you know, we've brought in our scientific experts on this. We're going over the hole now. We've got excavation going on, and we're really trying to determine.
Where is that rabbit hole? I want to try.
It's right here beneath the table.
Well, yes, I believe not only did Alice go down that rabbit hole, but all of us who read about her went down that rabbit hole with her. That, you know, when you read a book as a child, and sometimes as an adult as well, I had this feeling reading Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch, you are suddenly living and breathing, and you're breathing the air of that work. You're there. You may not necessarily identify with the protagonist, but you're watching and witnessing. You're feeling things. You know, when Alice falls down that rabbit hole, we're terrified as well. And she becomes our companion in these adventures. She may take the lead, but we follow her.
And at the same speed, did you notice that as she's falling, the genius of Lewis Carroll able to catch the speed as things went by? You know, he went down and saw things on the wall. He even caught the speed, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, and the jar of marmalade catches and puts. You have to have order, this anxiety about order in the most disorderly, anarchic situation possible.
That is incredible to hear those words in this part of the show, because when we were discussing the tremendous vitriol and obsession with the Amanda Knox trial online, one of the professors of law that I quoted was he says internet shaming is done by people who actually want to enforce norms and make people and society more normal in the midst of something very anarchic and very hard to regulate. So it's interesting that, you know, these truths are kind of present in many different discussions.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And Alice in Wonderland is so much about, you know, enforcing boundaries in a way, our need for that, and our terror in the face of, you know, this kind of nonsense, a lack of meaning.
Mm. And so do you think that, I know there's a lot of pushback against the traditional fairy tales these days because they so commonly cast women in a role that is just totally passive, waiting for a man to rescue her, sort of. Do you think that these are stories we should kind of consign to the rubbish heap, or how do you think that they speak to children in this day and age?
Oh, well, I think, first of all, we don't want to consign anything to the rubbish heap because we have to have historical memory. On the other hand, you know, you're absolutely right. These stories are sexist, they're misogynistic, they're racist, they have all kinds of, you know, everybody's lying and cheating their way to wealth, and all sorts of terrible things happen. But, you know, these are stories that... First, you know, if you read them with a child, the first thing you do is talk about them. You know, it's, I mean, these days, actually, we have sympathy for the wolf in many ways. But I think it's important to remember that these stories are not written in granite. Every culture reinvents them. So we can make Little Red Riding Hood our own. We can write our own versions of that story. There's nothing sacred about the Grimm's Little Red Riding Hood. But I also think that, you know, there's no harm done in, you know, it's within limits, I would say. And, you know, some children love the scary stuff and others are terrified by it. And adults have to kind of observe the child and see what is happening. But some kids love the scary things in those stories. And you kind of... can help the child, I think, by talking about, you know, why is that scary? What is it about that particular scene? And in some cases, I think children just need to work through some of the great existential mysteries about death, you know, and the meaning of life through these stories in a symbolic form.
Well, there's quite a discussion about the story Good Night, Moon, in terms of whether that is... comforting or distressing, especially in terms of, is it talking about death? Is it talking about, you know, going to sleep and not waking up and so forth? But you make a point of even children read critically. In other words, they're not necessarily going to buy into what everything the characters in the story do.
Absolutely. I think you never know how a child is going to respond. And that is why that, I think that conversational reading early on is so important because they're critical readers. They also misunderstand a lot. They misread many, just as we as adults misread as well. So I think, you know, that critical conversation about the story helps to, you know, just kind of digest things and helps us use the story as a vehicle for understanding our own identity, not just understanding the other, the monster, the scary person, but also figuring out who we are and what our identity is and what we value and what we treasure.
You've talked about reading as being a moral technology. I'm fascinated by that. Can you tell us what you mean?
Well, I borrow that term from Steven Pinker, who uses it to describe what happens to us when we read. That is, you know, we do have a way of, we talked about this earlier, putting ourselves in somebody else's shoes, getting inside their skin. We use all these phrases. We get to read the minds of fictional characters in ways that we can't in real life. And one of the things that Steven Pinker tells us is that psychologists have discovered that art is just about the closest we get to real life. Art kind of amplifies real life in ways. And so we start to... I never like this idea of living vicariously in fiction because it's got a kind of bad connotation. But in fact, there's something I think very positive about witnessing and exploring with somebody else and understanding their perspective and getting to know somebody who is not at all like you.
You know, in our next segment, I'd like to go into that a little bit more and compare the traditional storybook with some of the technologies for reading now. And in before we do that, we're going to talk about just a brief message about another show.
And first, I'd like to wish everyone a happy unbirthday today that is out there. And I ran across a very brilliant gentleman. His name is Jonathan Salem Baskin, advertising age writer. He's at answers.com. He has the answers, an expert tech entrepreneur. But what caught my eye with this gentleman is that he has written a book about its social media phenomena as not as much of a change as we thought it was. In other words, everyone is focused on the technology, and I just want to tie that in a little bit. His book is called Today in the Histories of Social Media, and all he's really doing is saying that the social networks, the social lizing that we're going through right now is really old, and he goes back in history. So Jonathan Salem, and I just want to talk about that. Maybe we'll tie that in as we keep going.
Baskin, right?
Yes, Jonathan Salem Baskin. It has a flair to it.
Okay.
And by the way, he's at Jonathan Salem on Twitter, and you can get his seven books at Amazon. Thank you.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
This moment of uncontrollable laughter was made possible by a 32-year-old man with little to no coordination attempting to execute a simple cartwheel. His name is Sergeant Warner, but young James, our laughing friend here, simply calls him Dad. The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show. We are talking with Dr. Maria Tatar from Harvard and the Germanic studies, where a lot of fairy tales have originated, of course. And Jim, I want to have you hear what Dr. Tatar has to say about Twitter. You were telling...
Here it comes.
Oh, well, I just got on Twitter, and what I found so fascinating is that on, it was a Grammy show, a friend of mine emailed me with great excitement because he was watching the show and following a Twitter feed on it, and he was having the time of his life. So, you know, and I thought, how curious, you know, there he is sitting at home, and he feels as if he's surrounded by friends and warmth and all. So I became very cynical for a moment about Twitter. Because I sort of thought back to, you know, at this moment of nostalgia, going back to the fireside when multiple generations were gathered around gossiping, exchanging news, passing on recipes, and also telling stories. Because those were long nights, and you had often dull household chores to take care of, chores that were repetitive, and the stories lightened the labors. John Updike refers to fairy tales as the television and pornography of an earlier age. And so I thought, well, wasn't it better then when there were actually real people in the room with you? But, you know, we're not in that era anymore. And, you know, I started to think about the upside of this friend's experience. And, you know, I'm sure he'll never meet any of those people on his Twitter feed, but he sure was having a great time. And so, you know, why not?
Yes, and you know, the idea of what 140 characters limitation does.
Oh, yeah, the poetry of Twitter. That is, yeah. It requires discipline. My first tweet, I'm not very good at this at all. My first tweet, I immediately went over the limit. I immediately got these flashing signs and alarm bells going off, you know, that I'd gone way over. And, you know, of course, academics always had, we have a long wind-up and do a lot of throat clearing before we get to the point. So it's a great discipline for us. And as I said, you know, I think it can really be poetic because every word has to count.
Can I get your Twitter handle? You're not going to escape.
Oh, well, I do have to change it because I signed on to Twitter a couple of years ago when I was staying at the Shutters Hotel in Los Angeles, and I liked it so much that I was Shutters LA.
Uh-oh. All right.
I have to be more creative.
I think that's pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
I like it. Now, I just want to tell you that Dr. J and I met because of a social network. We actually,
wow.
Yeah. A professor saw the name of the still to be published, the Social Network magazine, and invited me to testify to the Nevada state government. And then I went to a get together and met Dr. J there. So we met because of a LinkedIn connection. And I got to throw something else in real quick. So years back, this is a rewind, of course. Years back, I was walking my dog Mocha, the late Mocha the Pie, the wiener dog, and Bear Cub through the jungle of a dog park, which Jane goes to now. And very quickly, there's this little girl, the whole Harry Potter thing was just in the air, you know. Everyone was buzzing around Harry Potter. And I said to this little girl, "What is it about those books?" And she said, "It's the picture in your mind."
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Because you start to see the world, and then the amazing thing is we suspend disbelief.
Mm-hmm.
We see and then we believe. And I always think in this context of Philip Pullman, who writes, "What you see will shock and startle you." This is going to be exciting. It's going to demand, it's not a passive scripted activity. It gives us a kind of total emotional response. We just get hooked on the, you know, we're addicted to certain stories, and it's such an amazing thing that can happen. They're just little black squiggles on a page, and yet they have that kind of power.
Well, and Stephen King says real quick, he says, it's the imagery. Imagery occurs in the mind of the reader, not on the page or on the screen. You know what I mean? So that picture in that little girl's mind when she read, that's the magic, you know?
Right.
Interesting that you mentioned Stephen King because he wrote the review of The Goldfish for the New York Times. And we were talking about Twitter. Well, a Twitter hashtag with, for instance, The Goldfish, Finch. or any book that you're currently enthused about and want to share some thoughts with, a lot of times there is a Twitter stream dealing with it, or you can go to Goodreads or even your local library system may have an web page where people share their thoughts, or maybe they have a face-to-face meeting group where they talk about certain books. So there's lots of interaction that goes on around reading. The stories can sometimes be, especially when we're talking about small children, a lot of times they can be extreme or not at all politically correct, but that can increase or prime the pump for good conversation about what that is. Do you think that reading from a physical book with pictures in it is different, will be different for people as they read to their children, maybe from an iPad or?
Oh, sure. I think that the delivery system changes the experience in certain ways, but I would say that it's still the story. That somehow, you know, however you get those words, whether you're listening to them around a campfire, as our ancestors did, or as you might at summer camp or anywhere, or whether you get them through, and I love the way we call it Kindle or Amazon called it Kindle and Kindle Fire, sort of evoking that hearth and all of that. You know, it doesn't really matter how we get it, but we do, we get it and we see it. You know, just what we talked about, we start to see things on that blank slate of our mind, maybe not so blank, but that screen of our mind, and we're taken elsewhere to another time and place where we can begin to see how others live, how people who are completely different from us experience things.
I like to think of reading and the imagination as the first virtual reality, and dreaming, of course, feels so real that the suspension of disbelief. I've read a little bit about the physiology of sleep, and that the dreams somehow are when our brain disconnects that distinction between real and unreal.
Yeah, that's great. And that, you know, as you say, the virtual experience, maybe I should be more of a cheerleader for Twitter and the virtual experience, because in some ways it still produces the connection, only connect, and it's also, it puts us into this network, this web. We have all these wonderful metaphors for imagining how you know, we're not just atoms, atomized individuals. We don't live in our little cells, but we're, you know, we're somehow part of a larger system. And, you know, maybe we connect electronically, but that doesn't mean that we don't connect as people or find ways through the electronic media to connect on the real level.
There's a book that came to my mind while we were talking about the moral technology of reading and art, and that is The Diamond Age by Neal Stephenson. And it is dealing with a book that raises a child. The children are orphaned, I believe, and are depending upon an electronic book that is self-adjusting to them. So there's all kinds of possibilities in there of the power of reading.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, you know, in some ways we have to embrace new technologies and try to figure out, you know, how can they work for us? They may not be able to replicate the experience we get with the physical book, the artifact, and all of that, but they have other upsides to them.
One other slice, if I might, just say on Twitter, that fascinating thing, since you're just getting out there at L.A. Shutters, et cetera, is that when you, even though there's 140 characters, that's a sentence or two, the fact is we'll be able to put this show in a link, a live link, to where, as you know, we'll be able to, you'll be able to go to, I'll send a tweet out, and there's the show. The show, the link, is kind of the rabbit hole. When you see a link, you see a hole, but you haven't gone down it yet. When you click on it for a second, there's that suspended, you don't know where you're going. So, I mean, it really has that quality. So I really love what you've said and your interplay with Dr. J. Thank you.
Oh, thanks.
We appreciate
for the conversation.
Yeah, I appreciate this very much. And you and I both love the golden age of illustration of children's books. And those are featured in your book, The Enchanted Hunters, The Power of Stories in Childhood. And I think that of your numerous books is one that's very relevant to our discussion today by Norton and Company. So I would encourage all our listeners to take a look at that, Enchanted Hunters by Maria Tatar. And thank you so much, Dr. Tatar, for joining us today.
And any other contact information, by the way, do you want us to come to you, any links, websites or anything, Doctor?
Oh, I have a blog called Breezes from Wonderland.
Oh,
Breezes.
And maybe I'll put this link up when
there
you send it to me.
Okay. Yeah, well, we will. Right. And again, I hope to talk to you soon. And brilliant. Thank you.
Great to talk. Thank you.
And thank you to our listeners being with us again for another social network show. And if you haven't checked out the Journalism and Media Studies Department here at UNLV, just head on over to journalism.unlv.edu.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on the Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.